Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating. Today we'll be talking to Preeti Mishra, author of Language and the Making of Modern India, published by Cambridge University Press. Welcome to New Books in Language.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So we usually start our interviews by asking authors to tell us a little bit about how they came to be interested in the topic of their book. How did you get to be interested in the story of Odisha, regional Indian languages and their connections to modern India?
This book started from a very personal place. I grew up in Bombay, which is sort of the center in some ways of cosmopolitan India. And I felt both Indian and Odia, because I'm from Odisha. I felt it was okay for me to be both. And it did. There seemed to be no kind of friction between these two identities. And I wondered how that was possible. And through my sort of undergraduate and MA degrees, I started to reading about kind of the relationship between regional nationalism and all India nationalism. And I realized that this relationship is not as seamless for other places. For instance, for Assam or in the south or Punjab, where there was a Khalistan movement. So the nation and the region didn't sit comfortably together in the history of modern India. And this made me start to kind of, they got me thinking about kind of how region as a category is formulated in Indian nationalist thought. And that's where the book began in some ways. And as I thought more about it, I realized that you can't talk about region in India without talking about language in India, because most of the early regions of India, early provinces of India, are organized on linguistic lines. And that became the sort of conventional way of imagining territorial division in India through language. And that is how I sort of came to this. It's both personal, trying to understand my own sense of the nation and the region, but also a broader kind of rumination on how India lives in its different languages.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So your context then is the discipline of history, but you're also thinking about language in history. So this isn't, so when you think about the audience, given your, that sort of history that you told us, where would you situate the book? Just curious.
So the book is meant to speak to people who are interested in the politics of language in India, but also interested in the relationship of between language and nationalism in sort of from a global perspective. So how does language and nationalism kind of, how is that relationship working in different kinds of places across the world? So it's meant to sort of speak to historians of India, but also to people who are interested in the history of language in the world.
Cool. More broadly. Cool. Yeah, very, very cool. So your focus in this book, let's get into that, is the first linguistically organized province in India, which is now called Odisha, but was previously known as Orissa. Mm-hmm. So for listeners who don't know, can you tell us where it's located and what languages are spoken there?
Great. So Orissa is, and I still say Orissa.
That's It goes back and forth. That's fine.
Yeah, so I probably will mispronounce my own home state many times now. Orissa is situated in eastern India, in the eastern part of Peninsular India, just below Bengal. In fact, it used to be part of the British presidency of Bengal before it was formed as a separate state. It has broadly two main halves, a coastal region, which is called Mughalbandi, because it used to be part of the Mughal Empire before the British Empire took over, and a hillier inland region, which is called the Garjat. This is the region which is rich in minerals. It's deeply forested. It's set in the Eastern Ghats, a mountain range, and does have the sort of the fairly significant Adivasi population. In terms of languages, the official language of Orissa now is Odia, but it has a large number of Adivasi languages, about 21 Adivasi languages and 74 dialects. Out of those 21 languages, Adivasi languages, 7 of them actually have their own scripts. Part of southern Orissa also has people who are bilingual and speak Telugu as well as Odia. So it is a very kind of mixed linguistic space.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get back to this in what follows, but just briefly for folks who don't know, you're using the word Adivasi. Can mm-hmm. you briefly say what that word means and what it refers to?
Okay. Adivasi, for those of us who don't know about India, the closest term that would seem familiar would be tribal. So part of the population of India that is identified as indigenous peoples. These are communities that are not necessarily Hindu. They're not part of the Hindu religious group. They often have their own languages. They are quite carefully, quite kind of discreetly placed. They are from particular parts of India. Their religion is often animistic, and their languages come from different root languages, so they're not Indo-European speaking peoples either. In real terms, they are in contemporary India quite quite oppressed.
Yes.
Because they're not sort of properly represented by those that are in power. And it is these communities now that are quite intensely engaged in an oppositional relationship with the Indian state due to many, many years of oppression.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Great. Yeah, that's perfect. We'll get back to the Adivasi, but I wanted to just note the term for listeners who are not already familiar with the topic. Let's go on and talk about these languages. So in the book, you're concerned with languages that are characterized often as vernacular. And this is a concept whose history and application you explore throughout the book. So can you tell us how you understand what the term vernacular means, what this concept is, and what roles do vernacular languages like Odia play in your book and in what you're exploring?
So to start with, I wanted to clarify that when someone who's not engaged with Indian history thinks about vernacular, they just think about vernacular as the language of the place, right? However, in the Indian context, this term is used in colonial India for some specific languages. And these are the sort of major regional languages. So while vernacular in vernacular is often referencing to, you know, local languages, in official documents, it's being opposed to Persian or English or Sanskrit. So languages that have substantial speakers that the colonial state can't see. Those are the languages I'm talking about when I'm talking about vernacular. The problem is this slippage precisely, the slippage between thinking about vernacular as a language of place and vernacular as a language the state is recognizing and thinking about managing, is that these are two different ways in which language exists, right? So what I wanted to do is to think about how, when we apply this term vernacular to these major Indian languages, we come away with the sense that they are local languages, they're indigenous languages, they are in some ways powerless in relation to languages like English or Persian, depending on the context. The problem with this is that in some ways it is true. They are radical languages. They are languages of the people. These are the language through which people can speak truth to power. So there is a sense of radical possibility in these languages. However, within the context of India, what my book tries to show, especially in the first few chapters, is that these languages come to become quite, in the regional zones where they are powerful, quite powerful languages. They become representative categories. They become the languages that are official languages that people can use for sort of judicial administration or even education, etc. So these are not powerless languages. So what I wanted to do through the book is to think about how the vernacular sort of functions on both these registers, and especially the powerful register that some vernacular languages, counting on 15 to 20 now, are actually languages of power and languages of hegemony. They represent certain hegemonic groups. They empower certain hegemonic groups and disempower certain hegemonic groups. And so what this book is trying to do is to look for the authority of the vernacular. Where does that authority sit? How is that authority constructed? And how, through that story, we can see the story of the making of the Indian nation, that this kind of authorizing of the vernacular in some ways is intrinsic to the story of the making of the Indian nation.
Please go ahead.
So one way of looking at the authority of the vernacular is to think about the way in which it is used to determine territorial divisions in India. So to determine the kind of the limits of regional territories. And it is only possible to do this through what I call a sublimation of language, where suddenly, even though there are regional linguistic movements that emerge in the 19th century, they are often exclusive movements. They're Tamil movements or Telugu movements or Odia movements. There is a way in which by the turn of the 20th century, these movements have started to talk about places, Tamil Nadu, Odisha, Andhra, and they've stopped talking about language, because this place doesn't necessarily need to be an exclusive identity marker. It can be this inclusive space, and it can allow for other parts of the nation to exist in them. So it becomes almost invisible in the making of power in India.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So let's get into it. Let's talk about the first chapter, where you open with this story of Gopalchandra Prahaj, who compiles the most extensive Odia lexicon in the 20th century. And you look at his treatment of Odia, especially in comparison with Sanskrit, Bengali, Tamil, and sort of other Indian languages. So what kind of conclusions do you draw from his treatment?
Yeah. So Prahaj, I mean, could I just kind of tell the story of a little
please,
bit?
It's please, please do. Story. Yeah, exactly.
So he wrote these episodic, kind of a piece of episodic fiction, and he sort of took a lot from Oliver Wendell Holmes. So it's the same kind of narrative. And this particular narrative is placed in the Bhagavad Ghara or the Bhagavad Hut, which is this kind of communal space in Odia villages where the Odia Bhagavat is kept, the Bhagavad Gita is kept, and people read it out communally and collectively. So it is a linguistic space, a religious space, a community space. And in that, he has these four important characters: a English-educated schoolmaster, a law clerk, a Sanskrit priest. And what he's trying to do is to look at how they represent language. And he introduces all these characters in these very funny ways, where he says that for the English-educated schoolmaster, he had this kind of deep hatred for the Odia language, and that no thought could be expressed without a sprinkling of English words. And the Sanskrit sort of school teacher felt that Odia was somehow inadequate and had to sort of get as close to Sanskrit as possible to be able to express the thoughts. And then the law clerk was so imbued in the language of law that even when he spoke to children, some legal language kind of slipped in. And the idea there for Prahaj was to say, is this language, he's making fun of all these different ways in which the Odia language is being used. And what he's trying to get at is that we don't want to be replaced by English. So we don't want to be like the English school teacher. We don't want Odia to get so close to Sanskrit that it somehow loses its identity as a separate language. So he's actually kind of lampooning this whole Sanskritization process that's happening to a lot of Indian languages. And then he's sort of looking at how power works through this language of law discussion. And what we find in his history, in his treatment of Odia language, as well as in the kind of big debates about language that are happening in the 19th century, is the sense that there's a deep anxiety about what is Odia. Because in the 1860s, there's a move by colonial officials to replace Odia with Bengali as the language of instruction and governance in the Orissa division of the Bengal Presidency. And this is where the kind of anxiety begins, and this it continues into the 20th century. And so the whole sort of impetus of the debates for about 60 years is to argue that Oriya is a separate language. It's not the same as Bengali. So that the claim that it would be the same as Bengali would come from the idea that they're both Indo-European languages. They draw from Sanskrit and Prakrit, and they have these kind of deep links. So the counter-argument that the Oriyas produce is that Oriya is not the same as Bengali because it is deeply kind of entangled in the Adivasi languages of Orissa. And so Oriya becomes Oriya not just because of this high culture, Sanskritic, Indo-European status that it has, but also because of its day, everyday life usage, which is much, much more complex than the idea that it's just another Indo-European language would give us. So being Oriya, speaking Oriya, seems to be intrinsically trying to sort of intrinsically connect Oriya caste identity with Adivasi identity through this sort of entangling of the two languages. And that's what the first chapter sort of tracks. It tracks these kind of 60-year-long debates about this. So what Prahraj concludes by the time he writes his lexicon is that when we think about language, we need to think about how it's used in the everyday world. But at the same time, he seems to be saying that Oriya has been a separate language for a very, very long time. Remember the anxiety. Because nothing has changed in it for many centuries. So there's both a kind of conservative insistence on a kind of core language that has survived, but also this kind of expansive radical insistence on everyday life of language and how miscegenation happens. So again, the two kind of the powerful and the powerless vernacular sit together at the same time.
And in a sense, those two claims are in tension with each other, right? The idea that
yes.
A language has this deep historical conservative core, which hasn't changed, and yet it's consistently used for everyday life, which is exactly. Subject to flux.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Perfectly good. Yeah. Thank you.
Great. So another thing that I found interesting in that chapter is that you explored how ideas from European thinkers like Locke, for instance, came to influence these English colonial policies in India in decisions about the languages of education, you mentioned with Bengali, and of governance, and then eventually, of course, in carving up these geographical boundaries. And so these kinds, certain Lockean views and other views about language became influential in the administration of India. Could you briefly, I know there's a lot here, but could you briefly mention some of the ideas that were influential and how these sort of abstract ideas came to hit the ground, how they impacted things?
Yeah, I think one way of sort of approaching this is to think about in 1830s, the British colonial government changed the official language of the Bengal Presidency from Persian to Bengali, Hindustani, and Odia. And this decision is a very peculiar decision because these were not languages of power. These were not languages through which you could fill, you know, revenue papers, etc. So it's a peculiar decision. Why is this decision made? And when you look at the archive, there isn't a sense of, there's no need to explain this decision, which is administratively quite expensive, but they've gone and asked a lot of kind of district level officials, what would the change involve? And a lot of them come back saying, are you insane? Let's not do this. This is too much work. I don't know Odia. I know some Persian because I learned it in England. So this kind of, that's one place to get into the question, why is this important? And there are two reasons. One, it's thought that good governance can only happen in a language that people understand, right? And that is, I think that's the central point that one needs to think about. Where does that idea come from? I think that the idea comes from 1790s England, where these sorts of discussions themselves are happening around the John Bull Law controversy, where people, sort of linguists, etc., are drawing on older ideas from Locke and trying to argue that if you want good liberal governance, then you need to use language that is accessible by people, because a kind of official language obfuscates, it cheats, it lies to people. So using the language of the people becomes central to the politics of liberal governance. So if England wants to bring liberal governance to India, it needs to do this, no matter how expensive that shift is. I can leave it at that, but just to sort of explain that this is a very influential idea. So the romantic poets take up on it. And so a lot of, you know, these confusing things, if you grew up in India and you read people like Coleridge and Wordsworth and you wondered why they were talking about simple speech, that's what they were getting at. Very important linguistic figures in India, for example, William Jones, were involved in those debates. So they were also bringing it in. So a lot of Jones's ideas about language in India are drawn from that kind of political commitment that happens in 1790s England.
Yeah, great. That's, I think, as you've suggested, there's a lot there. We could go in deeper, but I think let's shift gears a little bit to the second chapter, where you take a look at the construction of an Odia literature in the 19th and 20th century. And so here, again, we're juxtaposing with Bengali speakers, yes, in part in the construction here. And you focus on a particular case of Upendra Bhanja, whose work is pre-colonial and comes under criticism in the late 19th century. So maybe you can talk about these two things and the construction of the literature, who was excluded and who was included and why. And I think talking about that particular case would be helpful in getting clear to our listeners that construction.
Yeah. So once sort of the debate between whether they should use Odia or Bengali in school textbooks and in governance, which was happening in the 19th century, once that was resolved with this acceptance that, no, we will use Odia because it is the language of the people again, they had to come up with textbooks in Odia that could be taught. And one way of resolving that was, there were two ways to resolve that. Either one, you write new literature, which happened, or you publish older Odia literature for school kids to read. Upendra Bhanja was one of the most popular, well-regarded poets of the pre-colonial period. And people sort of, you know, just rattled off his poetry before. But he was from a very kind of rasa literature tradition. He was very, his poetry was extremely sexual, to the point where, you know, the anatomy of women were sort of described in great detail. And this was very difficult for a kind of 19th century Odia, Bengali, British elite, because remember, there's a lot of kind of Victorian discomfort with sexual content that's happening at this time. So the case of Upendra Bhanja becomes a sort of conflagration where the Odia elite get divided into two camps, and one camp says, we will not sort of stop under sort of reading this kind of literature, our kids should learn this, etc. And then the other camp, which said, you know, this is unacceptable. And it became a very fairly complex debate that sort of moved away from school textbooks and started thinking about what is good literature and what is literature that is appropriate for modern Orissa, an Orissa that has not even been formed yet. So what kind of literature should exist so that we can produce sort of a new generation of Odia speakers? So the question of modernity, the question of the function of literature, what does literature do? These became the big questions that this kind of debate picked up on. The debate is eventually resolved by some really influential literary figures, one of them, Vishwanath Kaur, who becomes the editor of Utkal Sahitya, which becomes a fairly important literary journal, who argues for sort of a kind of almost a balance between these two ideas and saying we have to keep our traditions, but we also need to think about how to build anew. And to understand his writing, I try to build on Milindwa Kanker's idea of an inaugural moment in literary criticism. So instead of thinking about tradition and modernity as a question of impasse where they can't work together, Vakankar argues is that if we think about the inaugural, then the past is as important as the kind of future. And what Vishwanath Khora does with this discussion is that he sort of almost elides the debate and says, what is our function? I'm going to set up this new literary journal. What is our function? What are we supposed to do? And he builds this, this sort of a triangular relationship between the reader, the writer, and the critic. And the critic becomes the representative, almost like a kind of MP in a parliament sort of thing. And his job is to police it in such a way that the reader gets the right kind of literature. But the writer is also a very important figure in this, that you are writing to build new Orissa. So it becomes almost an economy where it is a very kind of liberal representational economy, where he's trying to build an idea of an Odia literary public that is responsible collectively to produce a new Odia literary world.
Hmm. And so I guess one other thing
I didn't answer your question though.
No, that's okay. there's a lot going on here. I mean, so another thing that I think to pick up on here is the construction of this literature in juxtaposition with Bengali speakers.
Yes.
I think that was another aspect.
Yes. So Bengali becomes this really kind of, there's a love-hate relationship with Bengali amongst these figures during this time, partly mm-hmm. because there's this threat of Bengali, right, where Bengali can take over Orissa. But at the same time, there is a desire for what Bengali has. So Bengali as a language becomes the only sort of Indian language that seems to have done well by colonialism. It has built for itself a body of readers that are very responsible towards the language, a body of criticism and texts. So it seems to have the whole infrastructure of modern literary life set up in a way that is deeply aspirational for languages like Odia or Telugu, etc. So Bengali becomes this thing that they're constantly aspiring to.
Right. And so there's both the aspiration to be like it, but then a simultaneous distancing from it because they don't want to be usurped by Bengali.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Great. Well, so let's then continue on. And in the third chapter, you pick up on something that you just mentioned, which is this Utkal Samelani. Or the Utkal Union Conference, I guess would be a translation as you put it in the book. So you mentioned them. Again, who are they? How does their early political concerns intersect with the Odia language? So in your answer there, I think there are a few key terms and concepts that we need to unpack here. Mm-hmm. So Praja, Raja, and Rajaniti are three of them. So maybe we can just start out with who are these folks? Why are they so important?
Okay. They are the first sort of properly organized Odia public association that is trying, they're set up in 1903, and they are set up as a kind of association of Odia elite who come together to kind of lobby for Odia interests, Odia speaking people's interests. Now, why is this important? This is important because the Odia-speaking areas, because there is no Odisha as such at this point, the Odia-speaking areas are scattered between different British presidencies. So a big chunk, which is called the Orissa Division, is part of the Bengal presidency. There is northwestern Orissa. There's many districts that are part of the central provinces. And the province of the sort of district of Ganjam, which is quite big, is part of the Madras presidency. So they're absolutely scattered. And in all of these presidencies, they are minorities and they do not get any representative voice in relation to the sort of central governments. There are huge costs to this. So in 1866, there's the massive Orissa famine, and the famine commission report writes that One of the problems is that it is so far from the center. The Orissa division was so far from the center of the Bengal presidency that help could not reach. And there were a lot of problems that this kind of brokenness provided. So in some ways, what this elite group was trying to do is say that we will become the voice that will represent the needs of all these scattered Oriya-speaking areas. This association was almost entirely very, very elite. It was very much like the early Indian National Congress. So it had, you know, well-to-do, educated men, some women, quite a lot of the princely state rulers. Orissa has had more than 20 princely states, and all their rulers, many of their rulers, were part of the Utkal Union Conference. And so they sort of were sort of insistent that their intention was to address the social and the economic needs of the Odia people. That is what they wanted to address. They were unwilling to talk about other issues. And one of the main issues that they were unwilling to talk about was politics. They said, we are not a political association. They did not want to be part of this political association, this political idea. They felt that, as one of the sort of founding members argued, that we are in no position, we are too young as a community to do politics. It's a very liberal idea that, you know, you just haven't reached adulthood. And in these discussions, something really interesting emerges about the idea of the political. What is this thing that they're avoiding? What is politics? For them, politics was opposition to the colonial state. It was as simple as that. Or any critique of the colonial state. This was a sort of determinedly loyalist association. It didn't want to take on the colonial state. But for them to say, we don't want to do politics, they had to explain politics. They had to explain Rajaniti as the term that they were using as politics. What is this thing? What are we avoiding? So in doing that, they started sort of building, sort of filling ideas such as subject, ruler, politics with meaning. And in some ways, to me, this is the kind of precursor to actual political activism, to understand what the position of the subject is. So they use the term praja as subject and raja as ruler and rajaniti as politics. But by translating into those things, they also brought in Indian understandings of these terms. Praja literally means progeny. It means the child of. This is not a kind of powerful subject position, right? We've all been children. We were never powerful when we were children. And Raja means very clearly Raja belongs to a very monarchical system. It is not a liberal political system, right? And it brings with it ideas of, you know, divine right of kings, etc. And then Rajaniti, if you translate politics as Rajaniti, then it becomes a job of the Raja, the niti of the Raja, right? So what they were saying is that it is not your place to engage in Rajaniti. We are Praja. It is not our place to engage with Rajaniti. But even as they were saying this, they ended up in a position where they brought in ideas of politics, liberal politics, because they were faced with ideas of Prajatantra, for instance. What is Prajatantra? Prajatantra is how we define democracy in India. And that's, again, a term that comes from that linguistic world. So it was a very gradual process. And it's not a process that just happened in Orissa. It was happening in across India. So Tilak gave many, many speeches where he was trying to explain to people why they need to be political, that you're not just Praja, you are political subjects. And he was using these terms as Rajaniti, Raja, and Praja, and was arguing that the British are bad Rajas. And that's why Praja need to take over.
Right. And just to make clear here, these terms, since we're talking about language, where they're coming from, you might hear them and think, oh, well, Rajas, that's a Sanskrit term. Raja, mm-hmm. Niti is Sanskrit. But these are terms from Odia, correct, that they're talking about? Yep. And then they're drawing on some Sanskrit etymology. Can you say a little bit about the language itself here?
Yeah. So the language, I mean, obviously, these are kind of Oriya terms as much as they're Sanskrit terms. And they are bringing with it Oriya traditions of rulership and power and state power. So they're bringing with it ideas of how kind of political power was divided amongst people in Orissa. So there are these arguments that historians have been making about how rulership and sovereignty in Orissa was always a scattered concept. It wasn't in the body of the king, so to speak. It often was shared with the religious elite. It was shared with kind of local chieftains and was shared with Adivasi chieftains in certain parts of Orissa, where the princely state ruler drew his legitimacy from the acceptance of the Adivasi chief, who would say, yes, you can be the king. So sovereignty was much, much more fragmented than we think of it as being. And then to top that, there was also kind of a rising new understanding of sovereignty from the colonial period, where these sort of 20 or more, 24 princely states, their understanding of rulership and sovereignty had already been negotiated in the 19th century between the colonial state and these princely states. And their understanding of sovereignty, again, was something which was a bit more complex than this kind of black and white kingship is this mm-hmm. single sovereign space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So good. So what we see is a changing, so sort of going back to the theme you mentioned earlier about the historical roots in tension with the everyday use, that we have these terms being filled with new sort of modernist understandings at the same time as being grounded in these earlier sort of Sanskritic understandings, sort of mediated by how it's unfolding in the region itself. Yeah, okay. All right, so that's the third chapter, and so one of the things that's going on in this time period is that we have the Swadeshi movement coming into existence and rising up in the early 20th century. So early on, as you said, the Utkal Somilani are saying people aren't ready necessarily for political movements, but this movement begins to sort of build. How do they respond as this movement builds? What kind of tensions within the society and sort of with the broader political world are coming about?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a very kind of fraught period for regional movements in relation to Indian nationalism. So within the movement, there is a way in which the early 20th century, so from sort of 1903 to the Swadeshi movement in 1908, and then up to 1920 when the non-cooperation movement happens, is a fairly difficult time in the history of Orissa. There are a couple of really big famines, and it is very, very hard not to critique the colonial state when famines are happening, particularly because Indian famines under the colonial rule weren't necessarily natural phenomena. So this kind of position of holding politics at bay gets pushed to its limits at this point. And out of this emerges a new kind of generation of Odia leaders who feel really uncomfortable with this disavowal of politics. So there seem to be, in 1908, during the Swadeshi movement, there are these kind of elisions and different ways in which they're trying to do politics despite the clear sort of notion of not doing it. But by the time we get to 1920 with the non-cooperation movement, the Utkal Somilani has to sort of, as a movement, as an association, capitulates to this question of politics and says, we are a political association. In 1920. And part of this is not just about, this is the internal tensions you're talking about, but there are external tensions. So in 1908 up to 1920, there is a sense that the All India National Movement does not represent regional politics. And this is not just a sense, the sort of the Indian National Congress very clearly says up to the beginning of the 20th century that they're not a social organization. They're uninterested in these questions. They're interested in these questions, but there are other spaces, because they're worried that the moment you raise questions of language, about religion, about caste, the association itself would kind of crumble because of the sort of intense differences. And that's the position it holds for a very, very long time. But it's only in the kind of 1910s that there is this sense that this is not a position we can hold, especially in relation to linguistic nationalism. And out of this comes this generation of Indian nationalists at the central level who start saying, one, that we have to acknowledge linguistic diversity and we have to give it space within the making an idea of the Indian nation. Second, that we as a national organization cannot survive unless we speak to people in their own languages. We are just an elite organization. If we want to be a people's movement, we need to speak to people in their language. So it's both an acceptance of kind of the linguistic idea, but also a kind of very practical question of how do we speak to people? How do we spread our political idea? Out of this comes the acknowledgement by the Indian National Congress of regional sort of kind of a linguistic division of India. So by 1919-1920, there is a decision to set up provincial Congress committees on linguistic lines. So the idea of India is formed in that moment of sort of linguistically divided India. At that point. So the Andhra movement, for example, gets its own separate provincial Congress committee. The Utkal Union Conference is happy to become political because there is a Utkal Provincial Congress Committee, even though Orissa doesn't exist yet.
So maybe just one more thing in this chapter to pick up on is, so we're talking about language here, but there's also, and I guess it's not developed a whole lot in the chapter, but I'm just wanted to pick on it because you mentioned it. There's also the question of religion in the background here too, right? Because there's Hindu-Muslim tensions in this nationalist context as well. Does that, and how does it tie into these questions of language?
It there's a sort of intrinsic connection there because it becomes the official line of the Indian National Congress in relation to religious difference in India seems to always carry this undertone of linguistic identity. So it starts in 1905 to 1908 with the Swadeshi movement, where Bengal is partitioned into East and West Bengal and on religious lines, where East Bengal is being Muslim and West Bengal is Hindu. And a lot of the important Congress leaders respond by saying the critique of it, the sort of recurring critique, is that you have divided Bengali-speaking Muslim brothers from their Bengali-speaking Hindu brothers. And the argument there is fundamentally that linguistic identity is almost a kind of visceral bodily identity that sits at the foundation of our society, and religious identity is just cosmetic in some ways. So it is what is important. And this is an argument that is rehearsed over and over right up to the partition, where if you look at the Gandhi-Jinnah conversations, Gandhi is trying to say to Jinnah, actually, we have more in common than we have differences because of our linguistic similarities. So the language seems to be doing a very important job here, because what you will notice is by 1920, they've not addressed caste in any serious way. They've not addressed religion in any serious way, but they have addressed language in some serious way, because language becomes the only category of difference that seems to be acceptable to recognize. And it's easy for them then not to talk about religion and caste, etc., because people have this in common and this cannot be denied.
Right. Well, let's. Religion plays a maybe larger explicit role in chapter four, where you talk about so-called natural Orissa, which is the proposed province that now there's this proposal for a province, and it is in many ways understood in religious terms, but not as you're hinting at here, exclusivistic Hindu terms. So we can unpack that a little bit. So let's maybe if you could just talk a bit about where does this religious idea of Orissa at this point come from, and how does it contrast to this idea of a sort of artificial, quote unquote, colonial Orissa?
Great. Maybe it's easier to go the other way and talk about artificial colonial Orissa is basically that this idea that Orissa doesn't exist in its real form, obviously, because it's not formed as a province. It's scattered in all these different places. So this is not its natural form, this scattered presence in different provinces. So that's why it's artificial, it's colonial, it's just not in its true form. Natural Orissa is something different. Natural Orissa seems to defy colonial rule and time, etc. It is something that is intrinsic to the Indian landscape. This idea of Natural Orissa is kind of expounded upon by not just the kind of Odia leaders, but also by colonial officials. So if you think about how colonial officials are describing the Oriya parts, there seems to be some sort of commonality in that description. I, in this chapter, look at this guy called W.W. Hunter, who wrote quite a number of important texts, including the Statistical Survey of the Bengal Presidency, Introduction to Muslims of India, as he called it. And he wrote this two-volume, The History of Odisha. And in that, it's a quite a big book, but what he tries to do is say that I am going to give you a template on how to describe a region. I'm going to do this with Orissa. And effectively, he says two things about Orissa. One, that it is a kind of wild place where no human endeavor has happened, but at the same time seems to also have some very modern people. So it's a juxtaposition of the old and the new at all times. And he uses the words like museum of people, etc. Second, that it is a deeply religious space. Right. So one of the defining principles of what makes Orissa Orissa is that it is religious. The people are religious. The land is religious. This idea is not just Hunter. Mughal era historians who come to Orissa also describe it as the land of gods. So there is this kind of sense that this is a very, very religious place. The idea that it's religious comes from the presence of Puri, which is one of the four main places of pilgrimage for Hindu India in coastal Orissa. The main deity is Jagannath, who is supposed to be an incarnation of Krishna, Vishnu, and it's sort of Vaishnav religion. And this presence of Puri makes it a really important part of kind of the Hindu imaginary of India. And that's why it's a religious land, so to speak. This idea that it's a religious land then gets taken up by Oriya leaders who sort of describe how it's a religious land through the legend of Jagannath, saying that it is a land where it's a pure land. It is accepting of all kinds of difference. Caste doesn't matter. Religion doesn't matter. Gender doesn't matter, etc., etc. And this idea of kind of Hindu Orissa gets defined in these terms. But it's not Hindu Orissa. It's almost like it's a kind of Hinduism which is different from all other Hinduism. And part of this is something that we can see with more clarity when we look at how Gandhi describes Puri, where he's not describing Puri per se, he's talking about South Africa, but he says that South Africa is like a Puri for Indians, that when they cross the seas and get to South Africa, they've arrived at a place where they're all the same. They're just Indian. So it's almost a national divine space, that the act of pilgrimage to Puri gets rid of all differences and makes you part of this one single community. So this is how Natural Orissa is defined. It's a place which is both Hindu, obviously because Puri and Jagannath, but at the same time, an inclusive, expansive, humanistic Hinduism, which can sort of draw in all other communities and hence is a kind of microcosm of what India needs to be.
Yeah. And so in this chapter, you conclude, just kind of want to touch on this briefly with a couple of questions about what kind of happens to this inclusive promise. And I just wanted to kind of touch on this real briefly, because the idea here is that this is supposed to be just almost like a sacred space, regardless of, as you're saying, religion, maybe gender, caste, and so on. You reflect a little bit on that at the end of the chapter. Could you say a little bit about what your reflections are there? Whether it's lived up to its promise, what kind of tensions have come about here?
So in some ways, I end that chapter with this question of, what is the what is the future of this gossip of Molotin Orissa, this accepting equal Orissa? And some of the questions are answered actually at the postscript of the book, right at the end, where I sort of talk about what happens to, especially the Adivasis. In some ways, this entire argument, and we can talk about this going forward, is standing on the shoulders of Adivasis, right? It's their role in Oriya language that makes it a special place, their relationship with the Jagannath cult that makes it a special kind of religion. What is the kind of future of the Adivasi peoples of Orissa? Are they beneficiaries of this inclusive cosmopolitanism? And in some ways, what the last 60 years have shown us is that actually they're categorically not beneficiaries of this. In some ways, this whole process allows Orissa to speak for the Adivasis without including them. So there's almost parallel inclusion and exclusion that is happening here that we need to kind of be aware of when we think about these kind of linguistic movements and as positive movements of becoming, that they are always operations of power and somebody is losing out in that equation.
Yeah, good. So that's, I wanted to pick up on that because I think that brings that reflection at the end of this, that chapter brings us into the next bit, this explicit reflection on the Adivasi, right? That you set up nicely in thinking about this ideal of the kind of cosmopolitan space in the previous chapter. So at this point in the book, we're thinking about the what is now Odisha, which has become a separate province. And so the Adivasis, as you introduced earlier in our interview, are non-Odia-speaking inhabitants, but they make up 25% of the population. Mm-hmm. And so there's this need to somehow understand them in relationship to this province, which, as you've just described, is now understood in some sort of a natural narrative. It's the linguistic story has been grounded in history. We have this sort of natural religion and so on, natural Orissa in religious terms, let me put it that way. So what strategies do local historians, once Orissa becomes Odisha, how do they interpret their past, the Itihasa, in relationship to the Adivasi?
In some ways, Itihasa, the history, becomes the most important strategy to understand the relationship between this community and the caste Odias. As you've mentioned, they are 25% of the population. This question becomes a fairly important question when it comes to the relationship between the possible new province and the Madras presidency, because there's a huge tract of land which the Telugus can lay claim to as much as the Odias can lay claim to. And for the Odia claim to function, which it does and is successful, they have to argue that the Adivasis have more in common with the Odia-speaking people than they do with the Telugu-speaking people. And it is in this battleground that we see how the Adivasis are incorporated into the Odia community. And to do so, they again go back to Jagannath and Puri. So the Jagannath cult, it's a kind of Vaishnav cult. One of its more unusual features is the fact that it is actually not a very clearly Vedic, pure Hindu cult. It seems to have very clear Adivasi elements in it, down to the way the deity is pictured and built, but also the originary myth of the Jagannath cult. Where does the god Jagannath come from? And the myth goes that Jagannath was actually a tribal deity, a secret tribal deity, and a Brahmin prince went out looking for him and ended up with the tribals. And through a kind of very complex process in which the prince literally just ends up stealing the deity, the Adivasis become part of this cult because it is originally their god. And this story helps explain the presence of Adivasis within the rituals of the Jagannath temple, where certain Adivasi communities, like the Sobaro community especially, are in charge of sort of the food in the temple, etc. And which is unusual. It is extremely unusual in amongst Hindu temples. And the argument is that this is a deity not just of Hindus, but of also the Adivasis, and that this and in some ways, what I say in the chapter is that there is this kind of sleight of hand that happens at this point, where the Sabaras, one Adivasi community, stands in for all the Adivasi communities of Orissa. So again, it's all the entire 25% that kind of get incorporated into this kind of Hindu Jagannath cult. Now, we know historically that this is not how it is experienced. There's the Mohima Dharma cult, which literally broke into the Adivasi, the Jagannath temple and desecrated the temple as an act of dissent in the 19th century. So we know that this is not how it's experienced. But there are traditions of sovereignty that I mentioned before that very clearly link power and the Adivasi chieftains. So all of this leads to this story of the Jagannath cult being an inclusive cult, and through this, a narrative of how Odias and the Adivasis are part of the same community, have lived their lives adjacently, the language of side by side, as I call it, and it keeps coming back. And a lot of this is done through new histories of Orissa that are written in the 1930s onwards, where not only are the stories of this kind of Adivasi cult of Jagannath being talked about, but also very careful kind of linguistic analysis is being done, where Adivasi linguistic terms are being tracked into the Oriya language and a certain kind of common history is being proved. So what this effectively does, this whole kind of strategy of inclusion does, is that it never undermines the difference between the caste It never undermines the difference between the caste Odia Hindu community and the Adivasi community. But it does argue that they have always lived by side by side. They have a lot in common and they are part of this community. So it doesn't undermine any kind of social hierarchies that exist.
So we'll return to that one more time. I'm going to ask you about your postscript, but before we get there, the conclusion of the book, you look at how some leaders of the Indian nationalist movement talked about multiculturalism, and we've hinted at this a little bit already. But let's take them in terms. So the major figures that you look at are Gandhi, Nehru, and Ambedkar. So maybe let's start with Gandhi. You characterize his view as one which allows both the vernacular and the vehicular to rule at the same time. So what does that mean?
Gandhi, I think, is the most different from the rest of the political figures who talk about language, in the sense that he tries to argue that there is no contradiction between having an affection for your mother tongue, for him it's Gujarati,
right,
with having the ability to use and thrive in other languages, for him it's Hindustani, this imagined language which is going to pull words and idioms from all the Indian languages, right?
And that would be the vehicular. That would be the vehicular.
Is the vehicular. So the vernacular is your mother tongue. The vehicular is this new imagined radical Indian language. What he's constantly trying to argue is that there is no contradiction between those two things. And what he does is that he argues for what he calls a palimpsest of a palimpsest of affect, where he says that your love for your mother, and in by extension your mother tongue, is the foundation of your love for anything else or anyone else or any other language. So by loving and espousing another language, the vehicular language, which would be Hindustani, you are not in any way undermining your love for your mother tongue. So Indians can be fundamentally bilingual. And they can even be multilingual. So he makes these arguments about, you know, I love Punjabi as much as I love Gujarati. But it is my love for Gujarati which is inalienable and allows me to love anything else. So this is a kind of easy solution in some ways to Indian multilingualism.
So that's Gandhi, but then Nehru, you look at his views and you say that that he simplifies and kind of domesticates linguistic difference, and that he is committed to regional languages, but he also thought, like Gandhi, that Hindustani could be a national vehicular language. So how does Nehru understand this relationship between linguistic diversity and a supposed national language.
So Nehru, I mean, what we need to note about Nehru himself is that he doesn't have a lot of emotional connections with Hindi or other languages. And he is quite, I mean, if you recognize his position, he's in the 50s and 60s, 40s, 50s and 60s, even 30s, trying to sort of deal with a multi-layered problems that the new Indian nation is facing. And in many places, Nehru actually argues that, you know, can we stop talking about language? Can language not be the problem? Because he's just exhausted by it. And one way of dealing with that is to simplify and domesticate linguistic difference by saying, yes, we have these languages, these 15 languages, listing them and then moving on. So recognition of local languages, patience, or at least, you know, toleration of linguistic movements that keep going till the 1960s, 70s, and an argument for a functional vehicular language. Now, the difference between Gandhi and Nehru is that his functional vehicular language is actually basic Hindi, which is modeled on basic English, which is about reaching, sort of drawing the language down to the lowest common denominator, stripping it of idiom or anything that makes it difficult for someone to understand when they've traveled 200, 300 miles from home, and making it this really kind of core basic language. And that is not the Hindustani that Gandhi is imagining at all. His Hindustani is actually immensely richer than this basic Hindi. So for Nehru, it's about simplifying.
Right, right. And then finally, you look at Ambedkar, who he is concerned, of course, famously with Dalits, mm-hmm. but he doesn't discuss the Adivasi community when he's thinking about these linguistic states. So why do you think that was, and what do you think it shows us about the relationship between Adivasis and linguistic states?
Yeah, I think the thing with Ambedkar is that in his discussions of the linguistic states, he seems to be worried about the concept of the minority. But the minority here are the Dalits, not the Adivasis at all, because he sees them as people who are scattered in public spaces, in urban as well as rural places, right? That's the Dalit life in some ways. They are a minority in every colony, every space that you can find in India. The Adivasis are categorically a different group. They are fundamentally landed. Right. So historically, in terms of administration, Adivasis have been put in, and I use this term not because it applies properly, but it's familiar, put in ghettos, but their own ghettos. Like they are in their own reservations. Again, this is a term that does not apply properly to Adivasis. Their own areas. Right. They're indigenous to a certain forested area, and that's where they are. And the colonial state makes sure that they are protected within those areas. So the colonial state sets up agency traps to do that, to exclude the functioning of normal liberal law in those areas. So they've always been these kind of small pockets in which they live. They don't look like minorities. The Koraput district or even Ganjam, especially Koraput district, is not a minority Adivasi population, right? It's almost 70% Adivasi. So if we think about the Adivasis as minority, yes, nationally we can, but in particular spaces they are not. And that makes it very hard for someone who's talking in terms of minorities to address the question of Adivasis. And this is why I ended that chapter with someone who is committed to the Adivasi cause rather than the minority cause. And that is Jaipal Singh, who represents the movement for Jharkhand, which eventually is formed in 2000. And he argues for Adivasi rights in terms that seem very prescient to us now, where he's talking about displacement, he's talking about, you're all talking about these Adivasis as though they're just numbers. They are not numbers, they're people. Because what Jaipal Singh's critique shows us is that in the formation of linguistically defined India in the 50s and 60s, all these Adivasi areas, not just the Oriya Adivasi areas, are just being bartered between different provinces. So there are areas that are being fought between Maharashtra and Karnataka, or between Bengal and Assam. And the arguments are very similar to the kinds of arguments that the Uriyas were making about adjacency, about common history, about familiarity. So there is a way in which Adivasi India has been kind of divided into these provinces by making them invisible. And that's what I try to argue, that they have become the invisible minority. Because when you look at the map of India, you cannot see them till 2000 when Jharkhand is formed.
Yeah. And Singh has that nice quote that you included about the quote-unquote bluff of past history, where he's pointing to these historical narratives that we've been talking about throughout our interview, that he doesn't think that they're going to work, or that they shouldn't work, rather, to justify these decisions.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice. So let's conclude then with your postscript. You mentioned that some of the questions that we raised earlier were answered there. And I think maybe the main question that you put to yourself, and I guess to the readers of this book, is whether it was in the best interests of the Adivasis to be absorbed into the Odia community. What do you think about that question? How would you answer it?
It's the only way to answer it is that no, it wasn't. Because if we look at the experience of Adivasis right from 1950, so the moment India becomes independent, Adivasis of Orissa start getting displaced. So big dams are built on their lands and they have to be displaced, or big factories are being built. The Hirakud Dam, which is one of the largest dams in Asia of its time, was built in Adivasi Orissa. Thousands of people were displaced. The Rourkela steel plant is established very close to the Hirakud Dam, and that again leads to other displacements. And these displacements keep occurring, and the history of these displacements is quite sort of alarming. You also have mining projects, because much of the areas that are Adivasi Orissa are part of the sort of most mineral-rich areas of India. So mining becomes another devastating act that newly liberalizing India perpetrates on these communities. So increasingly, these communities have been displaced from their lands, put in positions where they've become migrant laborers, and their communities, their ways of life are becoming increasingly kind of dissipated into the Indian masses. And what is interesting is that all of this seems to sort of not jar any notion of what it is to be Oriya and what it is to be Adivasi, that the distance between the Oriya and the Adivasi, despite the 1930s claims about adjacency, is sustained precisely because of the 1930s claims about adjacency, that they're still the other, they're still people who needed to be spoken for, they are still the primitive and embarrassing, etc., which is very different from the kind of idea of Adivasi brotherhood that the 1920s and Orissa talking about.
Yeah. Well, that's a sobering note to end on, but I think it definitely brings into focus the way in which your book thinks about, in some ways you might think of, abstract ideas about language, and shows how they're incorporated into relationships of political power and the carving out of territory. So I'd encourage readers who are listeners who are interested in being readers and digging in a little bit more to pick up the book. I should note it is open access. So you can go to the Cambridge University Press website and download a PDF without any cost. And then if you want to have a hard copy of the book, you can buy that online. So we'll put up links, of course, to that. So let's conclude then by just telling us, what are you working on now as this book has been completed and is out?
I've just finished an edited volume that is more sort of aimed at those who are interested in language and postcolonialism, etc. It's titled Nations, Languages, Nations, and Multilingualism, Questioning the Herderian Ideal. Johann Gottfried Herder sort of is known most for arguing that one nation has one language, and how that works for multilingual post-colonial nations like India or South Africa or China, for that matter, or Singapore is what we are trying to sort of understand. How does that work? So that'll be out with Routledge sometime early next year. And for now, I'm working on two book projects. One that is trying to understand, trying to kind of push forward this Adivasi question by doing a kind of intellectual history of sacrifice and property in post-colonial India. And the other book that I'm working on now is about the pushing forward this regional identity question that this book picks up on by looking at how memories of maritime travel are deployed in colonial, pre-colonial, colonial, post-colonial Orissa to kind of various political and cultural ends.
Great. Well, I look forward to seeing all of those books in press in the future. That's a lot on your plate there. So we'll maybe get a chance to talk to you about some of that in the future. And in the meantime, thank you for your time and for the conversation. I've learned quite a lot by reading the book and speaking with you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.